It's really a great pleasure to be able to introduce my friend, our family friend of Kathleen and I and all of our family, Alberto Alemán. He's really one of the unique leaders of the world today, and I think you're going to enjoy what he has to say, both about the canal and about Latin America. If you've seen his bio, he's an engineer, graduated from Texas A&M, and in fact was the 2009 Distinguished Graduate Award winner. He was a civil contractor in Panama before coming to work as the administrator of the canal, and he has a unique distinction of having been a presidential appointee by both the United States and Panama. So he's been through Senate confirmation in two countries and has a commission by two presidents. He became the administrator in 1998, 2 years before the canal turned over, and served until 2012, serving 2 7-year terms. And what you may not know about Alberto is that what he did is he took a canal that was run like a regulated utility by basically an American bureaucracy and turned it into a value-added model, which is much safer, transits go faster, customers are satisfied, you can make advance reservations so that he charges them for it. And as a result, it's really not only an engineering marvel of the world, but it's a business, a great business model. And there's two other things you may not get from his glean from his public bio, but one of the great contributions he did was when the turnover happened, it wasn't automatic that the government would leave the canal alone. In fact, the government looked at the canal as a cookie jar. And it was Alberto's force of personality, integrity in the country, and his ability to make the arguments of why the canal should stay independent and be a canal for the world that kept the government from basically corroding something that could easily have been corroded in the early years in a country where they have their share of those types of problems like much of Latin America. It could have been like PDVSA or Pemex instead of the Panama Canal. The other thing he did that I think is really exceptional is when in 2012, the president wanted him to take a third term. And in fact, I even had the opportunity to speak to the president with some other people on Alberto's behalf saying, not so, you shouldn't do that. And Alberto said, you know, without saying it, but leading by example, he resigned or retired after two terms to show the need for a respective process, respect of law, and to fortify the institutional behavior of Panamanians. The problem in Latin America is institutions are thrown out, processes are thrown out at will. Look at how many countries where the Supreme Court has eliminated re-election laws and things like that. So by his personal example and witness, Alberto helped his country a great deal. I might mention he lives with his wife, Ana Matilda, and they have three children, the youngest of which, Rafael, is at the University of Miami. And he has had some very distinguished awards that you can read about in his public bio, but he's received one from King Juan Carlos in Spain, the Order of Isabella, and the National Order of Legion of Honor from France, as well as tons of international maritime awards, International Maritime Hall of Fame, etc. So Alberto's had a tremendous career, and it's a great honor to have him in Naples, and we really appreciate him coming. So I'd like to introduce my friend Alberto Alemán.
Thank you, Francis. Let me put the mic. Well, Francis, thank you very much. And it's really an honor for me to be here today, which you might call this is the Panama Canal series, because you have the author of the, in my view, the best book that has ever been written on the Panama Canal, that is The Path Between the Seas by McCulloch. So if you haven't read the book yet, do it, you're going to enjoy it. I'm going to be speaking today, and maybe my speech will be called How Did We Did It? How have we have done what we were supposed to do? Francis was saying, I was very lucky, and I feel very lucky and honored to have had the opportunity to be in a moment in the life of my country and your country that was very unique. And I think this is a success story, both for the U.S. and for Panama, and actually at the end of the day for the world. And it's a success story because back in the late 1990s, And I will go back a little bit further to in 1970s when the treaties were signed by the U.S. and Panama, by Torrijos and President Carter. There was a lot of commotion, a lot of political issues around that decision. There was a lot of international pressure over the U.S. about doing this. The world was changing, and we were in Panama were fighting to get back the canal. And obviously, there were strong reasons why not to give this back to Panama. So the treaty, actually, there are two treaties. There is the treaty reverting the canal to Panama, and there is another treaty that still it's on that is called the Neutrality Treaty. And that speaks about the canal being neutral and to be able to function for the benefits of all the countries in the world. And that actually has been supported by more than 45 countries today. There was a lot of doubt back then. There were 20 years in that in which we were going to turn over the canal. It looks like a long time, from 1979 until December 31st, 1999. They created a very unique system. They had a board of directors, binational board of directors, in which the U.S. has 5 members and Panama has 4 members. But the chairman of the board, we usually was designated the secretary the Defense Department. He will usually will give this position to the Secretary of the Army or the Undersecretary of the Army, because the canal was under the Department of Defense. And he will control he has a directed vote, that person. So he will vote for the other 4 U.S. members in any case, so making that decision stand. So it was kind of a veto power but honestly, it was never used. In those days, the first 10 years from 79 to 1989, the administrator or the CEO of the company was a U.S. citizen, and the deputy was a Panamanian. The last 10 years was the reverse, and that's the interesting part, because being the administrator of the Panama Canal Commission, as it was named, makes you run a U.S. federal agency. And we were only 2 Panamanians who had the pleasure of doing that. My predecessor was Gilberto Guardia from 1990 until 1996 when I took over. Sorry. You have to go through the process of the Panamanian president will present a name to the U.S. president, and then he will send that name over to the Senate, and you are investigated by every 3-letter department in the U.S. You know? And it took, you know, like 6 months for this to happen, because once the White House finished, then the Senate starts his own investigation, and you go back again to the same things. They ask you the same questions. You know? And then finally, I was approved, and there was a small history that the last month basically was an issue, because when you are sworn into any of this to run any agency in the U.S., you are supposed to say that you will abide and defend the Constitution of the U.S., and I said that's fine, but also I need to defend the Constitution of Panama, and that was a big issue. So you can imagine the lawyers going back and forth, you know, with a comma here, a comma there. So they need actually the president of the U.S. to actually accept a new wording for that. And so I was sworn in on August of 1996 with a big challenge of actually running the Panama Canal Commission then, because at the time, Panama hasn't had all the regulations in place. We knew I remember that in the late 80s, middle 80s, we had a dictator in my country that was Noriega, that thanks to the U.S., you know, you had it for a long time here in the U.S., now we have it in Ayala in Panama, but he actually has destroyed my country. I actually was forced out of Panama, and I have to move to Puerto Rico, thanks to Noriega, because I was fighting him as the chairman of the Contractors Chamber Association, and we were not people that he liked. But in those days, we lost all the time that was needed to implement what needed to be implemented, because by Noriega standards, we were in war with the U.S. So we only had basically 10 years to do everything that has to be done. So in 1994, we changed the constitution of the country. And so we elevated the canal, the way Panama was going to manage the canal, to the constitution as an effort to take away the party politics. And this required two governments to accept that. So we had governments from different political positions to basically accept that change in the constitution. Then we had to do what is called the organic law. And it was a huge discussion in our country, because that's the norm, the law that will basically make this work or not. And we started that discussion in 1996, just when I was just getting in to be the administrator of the Panama Canal Commission. Remember that we don't have even the entity yet, was not created. The way we did that in Panama was a huge national effort. Everyone was involved in this discussion. I had discussions in with people from the environmental part that wanted to see how we were going to do protect the environment. We have the unions and the labor. The Panama Canal has 7 unions today, so we have to deal with that issue. There were people, obviously, in those days very concerned, and rightly so. Internationally speaking, the time was coming to where Panama was going to take over. From the maritime sector, they said, you know, that we were going to, you know, kill the this golden chicken, and you know, and we'll take all the money, and you know, in Panama, we thought that we're gonna be making this like you know, in Latin America, we will close the canal for carnivals, and we'll have, you know, fun in the locks. And or we will have corruption. It was going to be very corrupted, and it was going to be a total disaster. From our employees inside, say, well, you know, we are all federal employees of a U.S. government, and now we're going to be employed by the Republic of Panama. You know, so big concerns over there also. Okay. So we have to deal with all those issues. For instance, under the U.S., there was no right for you to do a strike. So when I was discussing that with the union, I said to them, let's go to item 94. I said, are you not going to discuss Article 95? I said, no. And the reason I'm not going to do that is because it's about if we have the right to strike or not. And in my book, if you strike, I should kill you. And in yours, you believe this is a universal right. And therefore, let's agree to disagree. And let's ask the Panamanian people what they think. And if they think that you have the right to strike, okay, go ahead, and then you will have that right. What I propose is to have a system in which if we are in disagreement, you will have a very fast solution to that disagreement, but you need to continue to work. And I know that you will, even if this doesn't, you know, go your way, you will go to the Supreme Court of Panama and you will challenge, you know, that decision. And I know that you will even go further out to the International Work Organization, you know, to challenge the decision. Time proved it to be right. We said no strike. They went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court says that we were right. And then they went to the international organization, and they said that we were right. So in the canal, supposedly they are not, they could not strike. And I said to them, you know, guys, this is like the Ten Commandments. You know, it says you shall not kill, but you know, you see people all day long, you know, killing one another. So things could also happen. But this model in which we created the canal, which we decided, and we were constructing this from the Society of Panama. It's not a decision of one person or a group of persons. Everyone has to be in agreement. We needed a license to operate. And that has to do with many things, as you can imagine. We went and we looked at the companies, because the canal is owned by the government of Panama, but we wanted it to be run like a corporation, where the CEO actually is named by the board of directors, totally independent from the government. The government cannot get their hands in the canal. They cannot tell the canal how much money you need to pay them, and so on. And so we were building this. We went and looked at PDVSA. We looked at Pemex, Codelco in Chile, which is a copper company. We came here to the States and looked at the Tennessee Valley Authority, how they were operating. And we looked at the best practices. And I have to believe that the organic law is not perfect, but it actually is very good, because there are many important differences. We also took everything that we learned from the U.S. Entity. You know, it's very regulated. It was very strict in the ways, but also has to do about values. It has to do about things that you have to do. Put money into maintenance, that you have to take care of your employees. And all of that was embedded already in that culture. But we also need to change the same culture. And the reason why we needed to change was because this company was basically run as a break-even operation. And that means that my managers in the Panama Canal were used to spend all the money. They did not were managing resources or scarcity, but also they have words that I did not like too much, like that there is we have to have a lot of redundancy into things. So rather than having one spare part, I have three, and so on. That's very expensive. So we need to change that attitude into one that says we need to be competitive, and we have to be able to manage resources. And that's a major change. I had people who didn't understand what we were trying to do, because we have to be ready for that. Also, I believe in change. I am a great believer in change. So I said to them, everything changes every day. The way you do things today will change maybe in the next 10 seconds. And you have to think about change all the time. Another thing that was very important for me was for them to understand that they need to train people. And I asked every manager to train at least two persons to be able to replace them. I said, no one is irreplaceable. So that's something that they need to have in their mind. You know, be training the people all the time. So they, you know, you can go have a vacation and people can come over and do your job and maybe do it better than you. But they need to change all the time. I mean, you have to change all the processes. Think about that all the time, because, and I used to say, look at, you know, cellular phones, you know, the way that you used to call before and what you do today, or computers. And if you have a company like the canal that is not going to change, well, someone is going to make a way to compete against you. So this notion that we had in Panama, that if a ship doesn't go through the Panama Canal, they need to go around the Cape into the U.S., I said, that's nonsense. And in those days, the U.S. West Coast had 11% of the most important trade route of the canal. All the cargo that was coming for Northeast Asia came to L.A. Long Beach or other ports in the area. And then they were being transferred to the East Coast of the U.S., mainly by rail. So I said, we need to compete against that. We also knew in 2007 in Panama, we held a conference that we called the Universal Conference on the Panama Canal. That was to celebrate the 20 years anniversary of the treaties that were signed in 1977. And in that conference, they presented two reports saying that the canal was going to be without, was going to reach the capacity of the canal was going to be reached in the year 2011-2012. One of these was made by a U.S. company and the other one by a European Union company. Very independent, same conclusion. So I said to myself, we have a problem because what we are receiving is an infrastructure that is going to get to capacity very, very soon. So we need to do something about it. And we created a group, which was very difficult at the time, that I call it the Canal Capacity Study Group. And I contracted, well, I brought in a U.S. Army Corps of Engineers engineer to help me put this together to start analyzing what we can do about expanding the canal. What should be the best way to go? At the time, it was controversial because under the U.S., the U.S. and Panama did not want to do anything that can affect the transfer of the canal to Panama, not a single investment beyond what we were doing at the time. Because you need to understand that under the treaty and inside in the U.S., we have to at the time in 1979 they defined how much money the Panama Canal Commission, well, that was the U.S. entity, has to repay back to the Treasury that was still pending to be paid for all the works that were invested in the Panama Canal. So at the end of the transfer, that should be in zero. No money debt to the U.S. Treasury. And that's why in 1979, for the first time since the beginning of the canal, when it was operating in 1914, it was the first time that we raised the tolls. Imagine that in any business, that you have tolls steady from 1914 until 1977. You know, and actually there was a diminishing toll rate in the year 1938. So very unique model to charge. And then we have to start charging more to the ships because to pay that and anything that was being done in the canal has to come from the revenue of the Panama Canal. So when we finally put together this structure, we have to make it work not only inside of the canal, but also to prove to the world that we can do it well. I had a lot of confidence in the people of the canal, in the Panamanian people running the canal, and the Americans who were working also in the canal. In fact, we had a condition in which any Americans who were working there could stay, and actually some of them stay, and has been fantastic through all these years. And also to show to the industry that we could run it well, run it better, and also was a difficult time because we need to prove to them that we were going to change the model. And this is a critical issue because for the industries that were benefiting for all this time, you know, only paying the cost of the operation of the canal divided by every tonnage that was moved was a very, very nice business. And we want to change that into a model that says I will charge for the value of what I am giving you. And that was a very difficult issue to attack. In fact, we did not change the tolls of the Panama Canal the first year that we took over. We made our first change in the year 2002. In fact, the way we did it was that we said no longer every ship is going to be the same because under the U.S., they didn't care if that the ship was a cargo or a passenger ship or a container ship. Every ship was basically measured the same way because there was only, you know, you need to know how many tons goes through the canal to make that decision because you pay only per ton. And we said, no, we are in different business. So actually, the passenger ships is different from the container ships or by the bulkers. So we decided that there were 8 segments, and also we made a very small adjustment in the tolls. What we understood was that we needed to make sure that the canal was very reliable, because reliability was a very important word in the maritime industry. And the reason was that before, under the Panama Canal Commission, if you were a container ship and you get to the canal, actually it's first that gets in, it was the first to get out. So if you were a container ship and you were the number 45 or 50 in line, it would take you a couple of days to go through the Panama Canal. So you could not put a system that relies on time, just like if you are in a cruise ship, you know that you're going to be at 7 o'clock in the morning in this island, and then the next day at 8 o'clock you'll be in the other island. The canal is exactly the same. Okay? So in those companies or those type of ships required to be on time. We didn't have that before. We have a reservation system that didn't work. So we modified that, and we brought reliability into the system. So today, by bringing that reliability into the system, understanding their needs of our customers, they came and said, you know, we can use the canal in an efficient way. So today the canal has 43% of that business between Southeast Asia and the East Coast. The other thing that, thanks to a lady in the New York, New Jersey Port Authority that was member of the, we created also an advisory board, by the way, in which Francis is a member. And just a small reason why that happened. In the discussion that we were doing in the organic law, what we were discussing, they make a motion, and it was a very, you know, everyone was in a city just in a room just like this from different sectors of the society, and they make a motion in which they say, well, why don't we have like independent members of the board, people from the industry? No, it has to be, everyone has to be Panamanian. Okay, so then someone came with the idea, okay, why don't we have an international advisory board? Okay, that would be advisory board to the board of directors. And that we put that into the law. And it's been a fantastic group of people that has helped us, because they are from different sectors, from countries that have a lot of interest in Panama and the canal, from the industry, we have chairmen of the board of major companies, sitting and talking about the issues that we are dealing throughout all these years. And the other thing was that this lady, she was running New York, New Jersey Port Authority, said, why don't we sign an MOU with the canal? You explain me what you're doing, and we'll tell you what we're doing. And that was a fantastic idea, and we decided to start promoting that. And we started signing MOUs with all the East Coast ports and Gulf ports of the U.S., and basically promoting what we call the old water route, because we were competing against the intermodal system. And it was beneficial for the ports in this side of the U.S. that the canal would run well, because there have been more business to the ports and better trades. So that was also very important to us to start, you know, showing to the people that we could compete. So as we were start this canal capacity study, we came to the conclusion that that we needed to expand the canal with a third set of locks. In fact, the U.S. started building that third set of locks in 1939, and they stopped the work in 1942 because of the war. I have the I saw the plans that the Army Corps of Engineers had in Pittsburgh, in the Pittsburgh district, and I said, well, hey, let's look at that. Let's look what are the alternatives. Also, because in those days, there were no container ships. Containerization is something, I would say, fairly new. Started in the early 60s, and actually to start taking hold about the middle of the 80s. And that was something that was in the canal was mainly, until 2002, was more a bulk carrier canal than a container as our main trade inside of the canal. So we need to do something about that. So we start putting together what we call the master plan of the canal. So what we needed to do short term and also in long term. The issue was that it's very complex to put together a project like that. There are very important environmental issues, engineering issues, financial issues. just to name a few. And also, we had to go to a national referendum, which was kind of crazy because you are asking for a, you know, actually it's an infrastructure project to go to a national referendum. And that's because it is in the Constitution. And that was a protection in the treaty when the treaty was signed in 1977. We put two protections in the Constitution of Panama of 1982. One was that if the third set of locks was to be built, then we have to go to a national referendum. Reason for that is because then the U.S. could say, you still need to repay me for this work, and therefore we need to extend the canal turnover date. Or if they decided to negotiate to stay, to have military bases stay in Panama, also needs to go to a referendum. So we have to present to the country this project, which is was not easy, because we have to show to the people of Panama that we were going to take on a project that it was with a tax price of close to $5.3 billion in a country where the total debt was $10 billion. So it was a major bet. And also that we were not going to, that this project will not be guaranteed by the sovereign. So Panama was not going to give its government guarantee to this project. It has to stand on his own 2 feet. The good thing was that by 2005, the canal was a totally different entity. In 2000, when we took over, it was a $700 million income company with about $480 million in expenses. In the year 2005, we were already close to $2 billion in income and about $680 in expenses. So we were giving a good chunk of money to the Republic of Panama. And we were really running the canal, I would say, fairly well. So we were in a position to really present this to the people of Panama. You can imagine that for 6 months, we had a huge discussion about the canal, about the risk, about why don't we give this to the industry and let them build it and we don't take any risk, and so on. So we said, no, we have to do it ourselves. I think that we believe that this is a very important route for world commerce, and we are going to change the way the commerce works. Because if we decide to go beyond the Panamax-sized ship, which is a ship that only, you know, can carry close to 5,000 20-foot containers, we are going to be able to expand the capacity of the Panama Canal to make it twice more, with more capacity than what we have today. Because it's not about moving ships, it's about moving cargo. So we were very successful in this discussion, and it was approved by almost an 80% approval rate. And after that, then we started the project in 2007. So far, everything was fine. You know, the economy in the world was flying. Everything was fantastic. We started with our own resources. The canal said we will put $3 billion of our own money. So we started, you know, without any. We were once we were approved, then we started negotiating a package to finance the project, again without giving the government guarantee, which was a difficult issue because we went and we looked for MLAs like the World Bank. We have five MLAs. It's the IFC from the World Bank. We have the International Development Organization. We have the JBIC from Japan, the European Finance, and then CAF, which is from South America. And we were discussing only one term sheet. This is what we are willing to do. We don't want this to be a project finance. We want this to be a corporate finance to an entity that actually has a very healthy balance sheet. And we're not going to give the canal as part of the either. So it's only my balance sheet, the one that should support this loan. Let me tell you that we signed that $2.3 billion loan to the canal in December 9th of 2009, right in the middle of the most dramatic crisis, financing crisis of the world. So that actually shows that the project was very sound. that it's something that really was going to impact the world, because you see there are five multilaterals that are from different parts of the world. The Japanese knew how important it was for them, and so on. The U.S., of course, and Latin America. And then when you look at your handout, you know, I would like to talk to you a little bit about what are some of the major differences from the canal today and the thing that we're doing. As you could see in the last page, the one in the back, this one shows how the canal works. And what was so amazing about the engineering that they did back in the early 1900s. The U.S. figured out that the way to do it was to dam the Chagres River. They put a big dam over there, and by damming that river, created the largest man-made lake at the time, that was Gatun Lake. And that only allows that small, what they call Culebra Cut, is a 12 kilometers long cut. That's the only excavation that was required to be done by the builders of the canal. And then they put the two set of locks in the Pacific and Atlantic. So what we are doing now is actually building two set of locks, much larger than the one that we have today, and that's the other graph that you see, where you see the locks, the difference between the ones we have today and the new ones. This will carry a ship that is close to three times the amount of cargo that you can pass in the locks today. Actually, the new container ship that they are designing is close to 14,000 containers. And from the 4,400 TEUs, TEU means 20-foot equivalent units of container. That's a 20-foot container. And the gates are different. Today in the canal are miter gates, just like the doors in this room. They open like this and close like this. Ours are going to be rolling gates. Each one of them weighs close to 4,000 tons. They were built in Italy, and they were transported in ships from Italy to Panama. They are all already in Panama, and more than half already have been installed. It's a very interesting technology because they move this big, huge, humongous gates in the dry with a series of wheels, and they are able to put it inside the chamber with only 4 inches of clearance to be able to do that. It's amazing to see that you see a guy, very young person, only one, with a joystick, you know, moving all these big gates, okay? And they say it has to be done by a young person because all people doesn't know how to play games. So I said, I want to use it. No, you get out of here. The other thing that that we had a difference is that, and that was a big issue, was how we were going to solve one of the big problems. That was how can we get the amount of water that is required to move a ship through the canal. The canal requires, every time we move a ship, we use close to 55 million gallons of water, of fresh water, per ship. So on a daily basis, we use 2 billion gallons of fresh water to move the ship through the canal. And that is done by reserving water in Gatun Lake and in the upper lake that is called the Chagres Lake, in the upper Chagres. So that's the main sources of water. So if we're going to build bigger chambers, we will use more water. In the lower part of your of this picture, I will try to explain how we solved that problem. And that was to make water-saving basins. It's like big swimming pools on the side of the chamber. And the way it works is that you require that upper part of the water to raise the ship up. The lower part of the water is always is there, so you don't need, that water doesn't move, basically. So if you divide that in five parts, you know, 20% parts each, the first three parts, the 60% of that, move laterally by gravity to these lateral swimming pools. And then you lower the ship, the last 40% goes into the ocean, and then the ship gets out. When you are going to bring the next ship and race it, then you bring the first 60% that has been reserved, you bring it to the chamber first, and then you bring 40% from the lake. And then you raise the ship, and out it goes. This looks very simple. Actually, it's a system that has been used for 100 years in Europe, in canals over there, to save water. This was very important because it's a way that we actually recycle the water back. And when you look at this, with this system, the new canal used 7% less water per movement than the old canal. But more important is that every time we move a ship in the new canal, we are moving a ship that actually carries more than 2 times the cargo. So when you look at the water per ton of cargo move, it's actually a lot less. So this is a much more efficient system. And this was a decision that we have to make because the alternative to that was to build another dam and another lake in another part of Panama with huge discussions with the population of that area that has to be basically relocated. The other decision that was important from the environmental side, this is more expensive, actually, this system is more expensive than building a dam. The other thing that also was important was the fact that we could have resolved this in 2 chambers rather than 3. Because only the way you raise a ship 29 meters or 9 meters per chamber to the lake, and then you bring it down, you know, in 3 steps also. So we could have done a 2-step set of locks. Dividing 9 meters between 2 is only 4.5 meters more in height. The problem was that we will bring salt water into the Gatun Lake, and therefore we'll have salinated the lake. And that's why we decided to go back into a 3-chamber. The impact of this, just to finish, will be enormous. For my country, I believe that Panama is going to become the most important transshipment place in the region, because that's where you're going to do a lot of transshipment, because we have something that is very unique in Panama, and I just want to leave you with that thought. Panama is the only port in the world that has terminal in 2 oceans. See, because you can drop a container in the Pacific, and in less than an hour, you will have it in the Atlantic. Okay? And that is very unique. And it's so unique that in the year 1995, we were moving only 500,000 containers a year in Panama. Last year, we are getting close to 8 million containers a year. Okay? And we are still expanding our ports. Okay, so thank you very much. Yeah.
Alberto, thank you. That was excellent. We hope maybe you'll enjoy these as much as you do the McCullough book on Panama, one on Naples and Marco Island.
Thank you much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great to have you with
thank
us.
Thank you, Chairman.
We've got a record number of questions here, and I try to filter them through. We had many, many questions about terrorism and what terrorist threat does the canal face, how does the canal take measures to minimize that threat, and how vulnerable is the canal?
Well, the canal is an infrastructure and obviously has some vulnerabilities, but it's also very big in terms of it's not like a power station. So we have to rely a lot on international intelligence, because the way to prevent this actually is to be ahead of what, you know, people intend to do. There are many threats obviously in this world today, and the canal is not, you know, out of those threats. But really, the way that we work is through a lot of, you know, agreements with international countries, like the U.S. obviously. That everyone has interest in maintaining the canal operational. So we will have, in fact, very high-level industrial security in the canal. But in my view, the way to prevent something like terrorism is to have a lot of intelligence before it can happen.
Okay, we had a lot of questions about the Nicaraguan Canal, the impact of the Nicaraguan Canal environmentally. Is it practical? What's the chances of it happening? And in fact, this is one of the student questions, which is a very excellent one today.
Thank you. In my view, it's very hard for that to happen. I think it's more a political issue that, you know, they are keep dreaming on that possibility. This guy that created this Chinese company is a company that has never, I think, dig one cubic meter of anything. You know, it's a telecom company. It's a telecom guy in Hong Kong. So the Chinese, you know, element is over there. And that's the only difference. This is an idea that Nicaragua has had for many, many years. But I will be very specific. For instance, they need to move close to 6 billion cubic meters of material in what they have envisioned. That is 10 times more than all the earth move that has been done in Panama since the canal began to be built by the French. Okay? That's a humongous amount of earth moving. There's very important environmental issues in Nicaragua. They need to dredge the Nicaragua lake. And also, there's an issue that it's Nicaragua is sitting in what they call a very high seismicity area. And that has a huge impact on the cost of doing not only the locks that they need to build, but also the dams you need to build. Now, let's look at the perspective from the shipping industry. You save 450 nautical miles if you are coming from Northeast Asia to the east coast of the U.S. Okay? That's what you save by going to Nicaragua, that is a little bit higher than Panama. But Nicaragua, the Nicaragua Canal, is three times longer than Panama, a little bit over three times more. So in Panama, we take about 10 to 12 hours to move a ship through the Panama Canal. They will take three times more if they are as efficient as the canal. So now you're talking about 36 hours to 40 hours to do that. So the time you save, you lose by moving through Nicaragua. So when you do that whole mathematics, Panama is more fast and efficient than Nicaragua. Okay? So it doesn't make any sense to me to go to Nicaragua where you can go faster, let's say, to come to Miami. Then when you look at the cost of that project, we have analyzed the cost based on 2007 cost of the canal. And they are saying 50 billion. In our numbers, they are more over 100 billion to do something like that, not taking into account everything that I just mentioned before about seismicity and environmental issues. Then they say that it's something that has to do with China wanting to do something in Nicaragua because of geopolitical issues. Well, you think about that the cargo of China doesn't move in Chinese ships. Most of the cargo of China moves in ships like Maersk, NYK, K-Line. You know, they only have, the Chinese companies are like number 6 or number 10 in the list of big companies, shipping companies. So it doesn't make any sense to me, you know, that this is only for, you know, for Chinese shipping. And obviously, you know, when you look at that from the perspective of warfare, forget it. You know, nowadays doesn't have anything to do with that. So I don't see it.
Alberto, that's a great segue into another question about the Chinese. Is how does a Chinese organization become involved in the canal operation?
Well, guys, I have to go to the U.S. Senate. In 1999, October of 1999, because they have this crazy idea, and it has to do with Hutchison Whampoa having a concession to run two ports in Panama. And they called me one day, the head of the Senate, to say to me that I need to come to Washington to talk to the Senate, to a hearing in the Senate, to explain, you know, if the Chinese were running the Panama Canal. I said to the Senator, you're asking me to go to the Senate to say that the Chinese has taken over the Panama Canal and the canal is under the Department of Defense. So it's, you know, they have taken the eggs of the eagle. So said, well, Alberto, you have to explain that. that is nonsense. I said, yeah, well, I will say it. And actually, there was a group of people saying that the Chinese, because they were running these two port facilities, which they also run the biggest port in England, and is one of the largest, if not the largest, port operator in the world. So that's how it came about. There are no Chinese running the canal, has never been any Chinese running the canal. But nevertheless, they create this issue that actually, you know, has been lingering over there with no base whatsoever. So believe me, they have never been run by the Chinese. They have nothing to do with it. They are only, Hutchison Whampoa has two concessions, just like another U.S. company, which is a Zero Service of America, has the biggest port facility in Panama. It's being run by them. So all the ports in Panama are privatized. You got Singapore Port Authority, you got Evergreen, you got Hutchison Whampoa, and you got SSAA running the ports in Panama.
Let's get another student question here. What influenced or inspired you most to pursue this career?
I have to tell you that that you never know what you're going to do. I never thought in my life that I would be running the Panama Canal, not in my wildest dreams. So you don't know what God has in line for you. Obviously, when they asked me if I was willing to take this, I didn't really understood the dimensions of what I was going to get involved with. And but I believe that honestly, as I mentioned before, I believe a lot in change. I believe that you have to bring values as your top thing, that you don't change the values that you know you have. And you have to institutionalize values in your corporations. And they have to live by that and they have to die by that. And that's very important. Also, you need to have a sense of mission, and you need to be able to lead that into the organization. So it's been, for me, a fantastic experience. It allows me to understand better things in the world. And also, I have to say that, you know, we are very proud in Panama, because maybe for the first time in our history, what we did in Panama actually make the U.S. do a lot of things that they were not thinking about doing, like changing the ports in the east coast of the U.S. So our decision changed things in the... and I believe that if you are, you believe strongly in what you believe, you have to stand on that, and you have to, you know, to be able to take criticism and also use that as an advantage, you know, and not simply reject those things. So I think that I've been very lucky, and I thank God for that, to give me that opportunity to work with a fantastic group of people and to be able to lead them.
There's been a rumor that the new set of locks will reach capacity in 2020. Is that accurate, or are there any plans to go beyond the third set of locks?
Well, that would be a fantastic problem to have, because that means that we'll be moving 600 million tons, and that will be making a lot of money. Actually, the locks are, in our studies, when we put this together, we thought that by 2035, the canal will be... we need to have another set of locks built. I think it's going to be sooner than that. And the reason for that is that the impact, we didn't even measure that. There are things like we could not take into account, like the fracking that allows the U.S. to now to have a lot of gas. And LNG, for instance, was not a segment that we were looking at back in 2005. Now it's a very important segment of the new canal, because now you can move those ships through the Panama Canal, which you cannot do before, or even now in the new locks. And that has a major impact, not only from trade from the U.S. East Coast to Asia, but also from gas that is being taken out in Peru in the Camisea project that also goes to Europe. So now we have a new trade that we didn't have before. And also the industry understands that the new dimensions because we've broken down that restriction of the Panamax size ship. Panamax means the maximum size of a ship that can fit the locks today. If you can build a ship that is 2.5 or 3 times bigger in capacity with one same engine and the same crew, your cost per unit is very low. And that has a major impact in the industry. So when you look today at what's been built in the last 7 years, is almost all of that is in post-Panamax ships. So the demand is going to be there faster than what we thought. And that would be fantastic for us to take that challenge, because we envision that in a fourth lane.
Okay, we have two more. Okay.
Sure.
This had three questions like this. Very interesting question. The day of your Senate confirmation, on the day of your Senate confirmation, were there any particular exchanges or vignettes with the senators that stand out?
Actually, I didn't have to go to a confirmation hearing. The Senate decided when they had all this inquiry made that I did not require to go to the hearing. They sent my name to the floor and it was approved. So I did not have to go through that process. Thank God.
Lucky you.
Yeah.
Okay, last question is kind of a big picture question that you can finish up with is, what are the biggest challenges facing the canal today?
I think that it's competition. That's one. The canal will need to be competing. Also, the canal has to continue to be separated from the party politics, because, you know, there's always been that attempt to get into the canal. That doesn't mean that because it's in the law, you know, people won't try to have their say. That independence is very important, so that we continue, you know, to be as it was designed. I always believe that, you know, when we look at PDVSA, for instance, in Venezuela, you know, it was a company that was very well run. Today is a disaster. So again, change. You know, things can change. So there's always something over there. The other thing is, I think it's the water. Water is a very critical issue. We have been very successful in Panama in the canal. Actually, the canal in our constitution is the only entity in Panama that has control over a natural resource. All the hydric resource of the watershed of the canal, that is under the Panama Canal Authority control. So we have to deal with communities. It's very complex. You have to deal with communities. You have to deal with people understanding that you cannot pass a law saying, you know, you should not cut that tree. It doesn't do anything because the guys are very poor and they might need the land to, put some crops. So you need to change that. And basically what we have done is to tell the people, don't cut the tree and I will give you something for that. You know, if you protect that. So we have been using different models into reforestation programs. But if we don't continue to do that and protect that beautiful watershed that produces such a large amount of water, then, you know, you can risk, you know, the sustainability of the canal in long term. We will have that challenge when we go to the fourth lane. In fact, if we go to a fourth lane, I think that we should need to shut down the old system, because it will be much efficient, the one that we have. So those for me are the biggest threat, and obviously we can never, you know, put our guards down regarding how things have changed since 9/11. That's also something that is very critical for us, because you need to imagine that if something happens to the canal, you know, it happens to can affect the body of water where we in Panama, our main cities, take the water from to drink. So it's not only for moving ships, but also for its drinking water. So it's very critical for us to have a very good, sustainable system, ecological system in the canal. So for those of you who haven't seen the canal, when you transit through the canal, you will see a fantastic biosphere, basically, beautiful forest in this lake, because it's all protected, you know, for to keep the water as a main source, which is what the canal does. At the end of the day, the canal is a huge operation that uses water. And that, I think, is one of the most critical things. So thank you again for your patience.
Thanks, Alberto.